First of all, the recording is working, so let me just state the date. Today is Monday morning, September 7th, 2015. And a lot has been happening in the Torah world, both here and in the United States. And what happens in the States affects us here. And I've gotten endless questions, and I see I can't avoid it, so I'm announcing that the Sunday before Yom Kippur will be a press conference. Now, a new student just asked me, what is a press conference? Rabbi Lichtenstein introduced the term. And Rabbaran would, every once in a while, announce a press conference in the Gush, occasionally here, and it simply meant that the students could ask all the questions they wanted on contemporary inyanim. In my case, I don't take questions. I come to the press conference prepared, dealing with all the questions that people have been bothering me with, and I state what I state. I may be right, I may be wrong. In 49 years, we'll know whether I'm right or wrong. I would like to believe that I'm basically right, but time will tell. If anyone, just to be certain, I'm covering all the topics that are depriving us of sleep. If you wish, you can leave a note in my box, the question bothering you, and I'll see whether I can relate to it. So that's what the word press conference means. Today, Rabbaran Lolo Leinu is no longer with us. Zeichet Tzadik Levracha. I don't know what goes on in the Gush, whether Reb Moshe continues the tradition or the other Rashi Yeshiva, but many fabulous moments happened with Rabbaran and the press conferences. Let me say good morning to the students sitting in front of me and to all those listening via the magic of the internet. I'd like to form a class list. I'm going to pass this around in one moment. Please print your name clearly. And for the new students, please give me a drop of background. Smicha, first year, Yeshiva College, 2015, as you wish. And those of you that did Torah Shraga, then did the army, just write Sanchan or Tzahal, and I'll understand where you're at. Okay. Now, I want to begin, just before we get into the heart of the material, I've mentioned more than once we've spoken about wine and Stam Yeinam and the problems, and today, you know, to the average Jew, what kind of problem is there with Stam Yeinam? They don't use it in the church, they don't use it for Avodah Zarah. What can be treif in wine? So a Talmud, a virtual Talmud, Chaim Znitzer, sent me an article. I can tell you, if this is true, it's absolutely frightening. But it deals with wine and what they use to help give the wine a good taste. He takes it from a website that deals with high-class wine. And what you can find out, the swim bladder of a sturgeon, or any number of bizarre and unexpected finding agents. And they speak about all the different things that can be used to give wine a get rid of the odors, the colors, give it a fine finish, make it smell better. And I'd hate to read to you volcanic clay, carbon, casein, which is a milk product, egg whites, gelatin, chitosan, which I have no idea what it is, kisselol, which I have no idea what it is, incense glass, fish swim bladder, and even blood. And the article goes on and on. So let me just state, wine needs hashgacha, period. Regarding the library of JTS, so my student Gedalia Friedenberg sent me the article from the forewords. Anyone is welcome to take it later. But if I read the article properly, what I derive from it is very simple, that JTS is basically shutting down its library. And all this talk that it's only until this fall is not correct. It's going to be shut down for years. They're knocking down the building. They're rebuilding. They're selling the air rights. The ultimate plan is to have the base medrash of JTS in the library, which means it'll be no different than Gris. It won't be a real library. It'll just have Sfarim on the side that the students need when they study, and the real library goes into storage, and it's really a tremendous ethical and moral question because who did all these treasures belong to? Technically, they belong to JTS. In reality, they belong to the Jewish people. And to put these volumes into storage and not make it available as it has been for the last 100 years to, and Rakefet writes about it in Washington, how he came into the JTS library and met Reb Moshe Big sitting there. And that wise Alec, I should say Rothkopf, the kid, says to Reb Moshe Big, Mala Kohen Beveit HaKvarat, right? Paraphrasing the Medrash, the Gemara, Mala Kohen, what is a Kohen doing here? And Reb Moshe Big answers me, in this conversation was in Yiddish, but he answers me that if JTS has treasures that belong to the Jewish people, I shouldn't be able to use it. And it's an interesting little story. It reflects on JTS, reflects on the library. Speaking of Hasidim and Mitnagdim and everything we are speaking about when we talk about the Lubavitcher Rebbe, I want to share with you a moment in time a few weeks ago. I was in America for 5 weeks, and the last Shabbat I was there was right before the Nefesh B'Nefesh plane left to go on Aliyah, packed with Olim Chadashim. Among the Olim was a student from this very Kollel, who had studied with me years ago, Eitan Holzer, who both got smicha, went on to become a medical doctor, beyond to become a specialist within a specialty, and he and his wife and 6 children are going on Aliyah. Of course, I need not tell you the Holzer family. I write about them in Washington. It's a family that's very dear to me, and the family that I taught all their children and endless relatives. But on the other hand, they saved my spiritual life as well. Read Washington, you'll know what I'm talking about. So here we are in the Holzer home in Kew Gardens Hills, the farewell Shabbat, Friday night. We're in the very room where some of the most memorable recordings were made of the Rav speaking at Sheva Brachas at the Holzers. And here's the family. I have a Talmud, Ben a Talmud, Manny Holzer Lo Aleinu, who is out of it. He's in a hospice. God should have mercy on him. But his wife, Norma, active, alert, awake, Isha Gedolah. Their eldest son, Jay, my student, BMT, Rehov Abamanel, 1970. And Eitan, my student, Chris Kollel, perhaps 2002, if I'm not mistaken. And the whole family, others, and Jay says to me, Rebbe, sit in my father's seat, you're at the head of the table. All right, I sit at the head of the table. Then Jay says to me, Rebbe, you'll make Kiddush first. So I say to Jay, listen, you know that I'm a Litvak, you're Hasidim. You all know that the Rav felt if you hear Kiddush, you're Yotzei, you can't make Kiddush your second time. When the Rav stayed in the Upper West Side to be at Moriah at the home of the Schreibers, Friday night was the Schreiber would say, Rebbe, make Kiddush, and the Rebbe would say, Mr. Schreiber, you're the Balabas, there'll be one Kiddush, and I'll be Yotzei, you're Kiddush. I said, you're Hasidim here, you're going to start in making Kiddush, you're going to make Kiddush. Eitan's going to make Kiddush. Your youngest son, his Nissan, is going to make Kiddush. The grandchildren who can are going to make Kiddush. You do Brachat Levatala, but you're Hasidim, I'm a Litvak, I'm going to be Yotzei, you're Kiddush. All right, so Jay made Kiddush, I was Yotzei. All right, now it's after the first course, everyone is relaxed, and, I need not tell you what a feast we're eating, and Rakefet rises to speak. And this is the way I began my talk. On the heart of it, I'm leaving out, it's to encourage people to go in Aliyah, it's a different talk. But the introduction is worthwhile. And I say, in the Holzer house, in this room, I say, what did I hear before? Kiddush after Kiddush after Kiddush. Only Hasidim can get away with it. But you are phony Hasidim. If you would be real Hasidim, how could we be sitting in this very room? And everyone's looking at me. And I say, I recall from the Rav, Volume 1, written by my good friend, Aaron Rakefet, that Rakefet tells a story quoting his Rebbe, your Rebbe, our Rebbe, the Rav, that in Haslovich, when the Alter Rebbe, the Baal Tanya, was running away from Napoleon, he came to Chaslovich. He davened in that shul where Mori Urebi spent his formative teenage years, where his father was Rav, Rav Meisha. And Mori Urebi said, where the Alter Rebbe stood, no one but no one could stand there anymore. There was a gate, a fence built around the Mokom HaKodesh that the Baal Tanya stood and davened. I said, that's Hasidus. There should be a gate around this room, a fence around this room. How are we sitting in the very room where Mori Urebi spoke so many times in the halls of home? No, you are not real Hasidim. Real Hasidim, this room would be blocked off with a fence. And let me tell you, I write about it in Washington. It's the second time I spoke in that room. If anyone read Washington, tell me when was the first time I spoke. When the two volumes of the Rav appeared, so there was a big celebration, YU, America, Rabbi Lamb, but then the Holzes that Sunday made a private celebration in that very room. And when I got up to speak then, I was trembling, I was shaking. How can I speak in the very room where Mori Urebi spoke? But that's Hasidim. Put a fence around it and block off entry. Okay, with that introduction, let's roll. No one has written the word of background. In other words, Natan Cohen, you take for granted that because you wrote in the other, I'll understand, all right? Maybe we'll work it out. Moshe Hurt, yes, so we know who you are, Baruch Hashem. Michael Goldman, Torah Traga, Tzanchan, Danny Kaplan. Also the same background? Yeah? Okay, let me just put ditto. The new faces that walk in, let them fill in. Word of background, what your smicha, who you are, where you're from. Let's roll. There's no question that going to Berlin was a very big move, and not an easy move for that whole generation. The Lubavitcher Rebbe's background, very similar to the Rub's background. They were raised in an isolated area, but both of them had an inclination for general studies. Whether it's an inborn inclination, nature, or whether it has to do with the environment, we can debate that endlessly. But there's no question people foam at the mouth. When I learned in Lakewood, you know, they would mention the Rav and how he destroyed his life by going to Berlin to study at the university. What I learned later in life was that the Rav already in Poland was studying in the Free Polish University. And very interestingly, he was studying law, which the Reb Aaron Soloveitchik, for instance, later goes on to become a lawyer as well. So it shows you that already in Europe, the Rav was interested in material beyond Shas and Paiskim and Reb Chaim. The Lubavitcher Rebbe too, we know the deal he made with his father, 16 hours a day learning and 8 hours a day eating, sleeping, and dealing with whatever other material he wanted to study. So to go to Berlin is not easy. We spoke about the correspondence with the rocket shove a gong. We compared it to the Rav, the big machloket. By the way, from South Africa, I received correspondence that when I described what happened in Rav Meisha's home in Warsaw and what Shulamit Meiselman describes, and I gave you the name Yitzchak Kasovsky, Rabbi Kasovsky, of Basin of South Africa, and I called him a nephew of Rav Chaim Moshe. From South Africa, they say he was a brother-in-law of Rav Chaim Moshe. And it could be they're right. I remember, it could be I'm confusing, when Nissen Shulman got engaged, so the whole yeshiva was dancing and up in ecstasy. And the Rav, after all, the girl was a relative of the Rav. As I told Rav Chaim Moshe's wife and the Rav's wife were cousins. They were all Einiklach and Rav Yisrael Salanta. And I remember they said that Yitzchak Kosofsky was a nephew. Could be he was married to Reb Chaim Moise's younger sister, and that the girl, the wife of Reb Nissen Shulman, was a niece of Reb Chaim Moise. Could be I'm confusing it. I'm not certain. I asked them to check it out because I remember Reb Yitzchak Kosofsky was a lot younger than Reb Chaim Moise. So to say he was a brother-in-law, I know Reb Chaim Moise's brother-in-law, Mitzar, his wife, knew was Reb Elchanan Wasserman. Reb Elchanan Wasserman and Reb Chaim Moise were married to sisters, if I'm not mistaken. But this would be a brother-in-law, Mitzar, a younger sister, Reb Chaim Moise. Could be. I told him to check it out again in South Africa, but if I'm wrong, I stand corrected 100%, and thank you for correcting me. Now, the Rebbe comes to the University of Berlin, and did he study there? Didn't he study there? He never got a degree there. Who was he? Can we get records? And here's where Deutsch did his research. Rabbi Deutsch, the Lyoshner Rebbe, did his research, and they come up with the records of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And what we learn from these records is that he was not a registered student, a formal student. He was allowed to sit in. Why was he allowed to sit in? Because he was registered as a student at Hildesheimer's. Hildesheimer's, as we spoke about last year, and I spoke about maybe 15 years ago in very great depth, the Hildesheimer Rabbinic Seminary in Berlin was the foremost Orthodox seminary in the world. JTS was modeled upon it. Hildesheimer was not a yeshiva. The Germans couldn't tolerate a yeshiva which didn't have a formal course of study. Man sits, man lernt, you sit, you learn. It goes on 4 years, 8 years, 12 years. The Germans were utilitarian, pragmatic, and they couldn't comprehend what a rabbinic seminary was. What a yeshiva was, but a rabbinic seminary that had a formal course of study. Now, Hildesheimer's, called Hildesheimer's, it was the Berlin Rabbinic Seminary for Orthodox Judaism, but everyone calls it Hildesheimer's because the founder was Rabbi Dr. Azriel Hildesheimer. His son Meir ran it after his death, and it was totally associated with the Hildesheimer family, and it wasn't the yeshiva. You learned, you studied, there was a scientific method, a scientific approach, and at the end of a number of years of study, if you got a doctorate from a neighboring university, you were ordained by Hildesheimer. The ordination was not Yora Yora, it was rabbi, teacher, preacher, and Israel, exactly the type of ordination that the JTS gives. If you were a tremendous Talmud Chacham and kept on learning, then you could get Yora Yora. But the original basic ordination was teacher, preacher in Israel. Welcome, welcome. Come up front here, three seats. You have space? Okay, I'm sorry I stalled off, but I gave the introduction. You missed it. You'll have to pick it up on a tape. And by the way, with Norman, I'm right. He lives in Lawrence today. I checked the YU list of graduates. So you may be right. He grew up in the West Side, but he lives in Lawrence today. Coming back here, Hildesheimer Rabbinic Seminary. Now, the universities in Germany were open-minded. I mean, it's so hard to believe. We're talking Berlin. We're talking Hitler. We're talking what happens 10 years later. But when the Rebbe went to Berlin, when the Rav went to Berlin, if you were registered at Hildesheimer's, you could attend courses, you could audit courses, is the correct English word, you could audit courses at the university, and you didn't have to be a regular student. Now, this will explain why the Rebbe needed smicha from Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg. The Rebbe went to Hildesheimer, wanted to attend courses at the university, wanted to use the library, and he spoke in learning. We spoke about this last year with Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg. The Sri Deish was blown away by how much the Rebbe knew and gave him smicha. And here, this following conversation is related with a source, by Deutsch, which is very fascinating. Rabbi Chil Yaakov Weinberg says, the Rebbe came in, you know, this young man, I asked him his name, he said Mendel Schneerson. I said to him, I'm surprised, your future father-in-law, remember the long engagement between the Rebbe and Chaya Mashka, it was what, we spoke about it last year, what was it, five years, till they got married. I am surprised that your future father-in-law agrees to your going to college. The Rebbe responded, how do you know he agrees? So Rav Chil Yaakov Weinberg said to him, then how else do you have money to go to college? I said. The Rebbe answered, Afamaisa frekt min nish kein kashes. On a story, you don't ask any questions. So you see, it's Rabbi Chil Yaakov Weinberg knew the score. He was a Litvak. He grew up in Lithuania. I spoke about him in great depth. I can't repeat everything I've said. I don't want to be flippant. Me magazine will call me to order. But you can check out the shurim recorded on the website. He was a Litvak. And he never made his total peace with the atmosphere in Germany. He was different than the Rav. The Rav was totally at home. You never felt conflict. He moved in the Western world as easily as he moved in the Torah world. There was never conflict. Rabbi Chil Yaakov Weinberg was a split personality. On one hand, he still was that Litvisha yeshiva boy. On the other hand, he was a brilliant, trained, scientific, Western scholar with endless knowledge beyond just Shas and Paiskim. And he knew the story. He says to Mendel Schneerson, how can you go to college? Your father-in-law-to-be, he supports you. He agrees to this. And you notice, the Rebbe didn't give him a black and white answer. The Rebbe gave him an answer which you can interpret as you wish. But it's fascinating. And I'll tell you more about Rabbi Chil Yaakov Weinberg just to understand his personality. He discouraged the East Europeans from coming to Hildesheimer. And he's quoted, and this you can find in the Sri Deyesh actually, the sons of Germany, not like the sons of Poland. The Germans have already adapted themselves to the cold environment, and they therefore successfully digest secular studies. However, the transition to German Orthodoxy is dangerous for those raised in the Hasidic climate of Poland, which is totally infused with enthusiasm and order. German Jewry is not capable of inspiring those who possess a different temperament. So you see, Rabbi Chil Yaakov Weinberg was acutely aware of the difference between Germany to Eastern Europe. And his conversation with the Lubavitcher Rebbe is very revealing, absolutely true to form, if you view it from Rabbi Chil Yaakov's point of view. In parentheses, what's fascinating is that German Orthodoxy, after the interbellum period and during Rabbi Chil Yaakov's time, underwent a tremendous transformation. And the youth of Germany, now coming to Hildesheimer, wanted more and more of the Lithuanian Torah. And they say it goes back to World War I, when the German army conquered Poland, parts of Lithuania, parts of White Russia. And for the first time, the German Rabbanim, who were part of the German army and were given responsibility for taking care of the Jews under their conquest, and these Rabbanim and German soldiers came in touch, in contact with Hasidische Yidden, with Litvische Yidden, and their souls warmed up to it. They couldn't take the kaltheit, the coldness of Hildesheimer. And that's why after World War I, when Reb David Tzvi Hoffman died in 21, from that point on, the two focal figures in the seminary are Eastern Europeans. Rav Avram Eliyahu Kaplan, who succeeded Reb David Tzvi Hoffman in 21, Lo Aleinu, he died at the age of 33 and 24. German Orthodox Jews cried in public, which was unheard of for a German to cry in public. The newspapers commented on it. And then they brought Rabbi Chaya Yaakov Weinberg, who already was in Germany. He stepped right in, took over, and he was, of course, the last figure until Hitler, Kristallnacht. And his relationship with the Rebbe, it's absolutely factual, as we saw last year. The one smicha that we know the Rebbe got for sure was from Rabbi Chaya Yaakov Weinberg. Now, what was the Rebbe doing in Berlin? And here you come to a very interesting chapter. A lot has been written, a lot of theories have been proposed. If you read, and I'll quote that sefer later, not today, but if you read the quotes in, there's a book by Menachem Friedman and Samuel Heilman, written in English after it was translated into Hebrew. And, you know, they seem to imply, what was the Rebbe doing in Berlin? Why afterwards in France? And, you know, they leave you with a feeling he was trying to run away. They're absolutely incorrect. When the Rebbe came to America in 1941, he knew Kol HaTorah Kula by heart. Now, you don't know Kol HaTorah Kula Shas and every Tosfos and all the Kabbalah and Midrashim. The Rebbe's knowledge was phenomenal. You don't pick that up overnight. All these years, he was sitting and studying. But my own conclusion is, and you can take it or leave it, but I think everyone is throwing out theories. I told you in graduate school, I had a wonderful professor, Professor Yoshua Finkel, Zeichet Tzadik Levracha. So Professor Finkel used to say, when you throw out a theory, never say you're absolutely right. Say, Halavai should be 90% right. I'm positive I'm more than 90% right. The way I view it is very simple. The Rebbe in Berlin, and this we see from the records at the University of Berlin, he never was a formal student. He was enjoying life. The ability to sit in classes of the top professors in the world. Berlin was the golden standard. It's like you would talk today, Charlie, Harvard. Yeah, you have a doctorate from Harvard. The minute you say Harvard, this is the golden standard. Morty, you taught, you were part, research, whatever went on. Harvard, Weizmann, the golden standard. The Rebbe was the happiest guy in the world. He attended this class, that class. What's interesting is, he and the Rav, they had very similar interests, mathematics, physics. Philosophy was secondary. The Rav only wound up in philosophy, I would say, because he wanted originally to do his doctorate on the Rambam and Aristotle and Plato, and there was no one there capable of guiding such a doctorate. So he did it on Marcus Cohn, who was a very fascinating Jew, neo-Cantonism, etc. What did you say?
Hermann Cohn.
Oh, I said Marcus. You know why I said, okay. Thank you for correcting me. He did it on Hermann Cohn. Read the Rav. There, everything is checked out to the end. When you speak, I always have the problem of that first name, as I explained yesterday. It depends what name you learn first. So he did a doctorate on Hermann Cohn. The Rebbe, they had very similar interests, science, mathematics. The Rav, I told you, when Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein comes to the Rav, Aaron told me this generations ago, Zeichet Tzadik Levracha. Aaron told me, so I said to Rebbe, I just finished my doctorate. So the Rav says to him, why did you get your doctorate? And he tells him English literature. And the Rav says, mathematics, physics. So, and Aaron says to the Rav, Rebbe, had you told me? And from that little story, you see so much. Number one, you see the Rav. He considered the real meat and potatoes was not humanism, was math and physics. Two, you see, Rabarin had such a genius mind that, again, he could say to the Rav, Rebbe, if you told me, I would have read, you know, I would have got a doctorate in physics, mathematics, whatever the Rebbe would have told me. It also shows you their relationship with Kulo Torah, that he's doing a doctorate, he's in Boston, he's renting an apartment, you know who he rented from, one of the first they were part of the first class of Maimonides. Two brothers, Milan, from that family, whatever. I don't know the parents, but I know the boys. He rented, and every Friday night he was at the Rav Shir for his family, for Aaron, and all those years he's working on his doctorate in English literature, and the Rav doesn't even know what he's doing. It's a fabulous, fabulous little insight on two giants. But and then when the Rebbe comes to Paris, when he is married, and then already he has to think of Parnassa and his future, and they were very, very, very happy in Paris. The Rebbetzin picked up French. It became practically her native language. The Rebbetzin Chaya Mushka was never totally at home in English, but she was totally at home in French, and they were very happy there. And that's where he got his degree in electrical engineering, if I have it correct, particularly dealing with boats, with ships, a very prestigious school like we would say MIT in America or something similar, or the Technion in Israel. And they were very happy there. They applied for citizenship. And if you could go into the Rebbe's mind at that moment in time, they were viewing their future in France. He was a Lubavitcher Chassid. He was the son-in-law of the Rebbe. There were Fabrengims where he spoke. He had tremendous influence. But to his mind, his future was to work in France, support himself, live happily ever after, remain a Lubavitcher Chassid, remain Kulo Torah, but no formal position. That's what I believe, maybe 90% correct. That was the Rebbe's game plan. And of course, Hitler changed it all. Now, we're coming to a momentous moment in not only the Rebbe's life, but the life of Kol HaTorah Kula. Logically speaking, if you were to come to the Rebbe 1937, 38, and you're a friend of his, and you say to him, man, you know, his friends called him Mendel Mendy, he was a private citizen. Mendeler. No? What do you think? Was tracht man? Wer wird sein der Mamali Mokum für meine Schwer? Who will take over for your father-in-law? There is no question in my mind that the Rebbe would have said, my older brother-in-law, Rav Shmaya Guraye. Logically speaking, he's older. He's lived literally with my father-in-law and mother-in-law. Those two families lived together. They went through the hell of the communists together. They went through the hell of what went on in Poland and the Nazi takeover, the anti-Semitism together. They're later saved together, smuggled out by that Gestapo officer. An entire book has been written about it. I believe he had Jewish blood in him. He was paid, but he risked his life and saved the Lubavitcher dynasty. There is absolutely no question in my mind that the Rebbe said, what are you talking about? My older brother-in-law is the future Rebbe. Rav Shmaya Guraye. Talmud Chacham, Yirei Shemayim, Chassid, devoted to my father-in-law, the late V'nefesh. And then there's another factor. The Rebbe had no children. And here we're talking about a man who gave so many brachot, so many people that tshuva their children to the Rebbe. I had a young lady, she's very famous today, was my student. Her husband was my student right here in this kollel. And she once said to me, yeah, my parents have, I have a younger sister, 16 years younger. She's the Rebbe's child. And then if you read Miller, you read Telushkin, the story is told by everyone, because he was a very famous man, Robert Abrams. And they couldn't conceive again. And the Rebbe gave a bracha this year, had a second daughter against all odds. And these stories repeat themselves 1,000 times over. And of course, it's an open Mishnah that Ein Hasur Matir Tasmo Bibeit Hasura. We can give brachot for others, but unfortunately, we can't help ourselves. So the Rebbe had no children. How much they knew about the matzah, of what type of medical help, we have no records. These are personal questions. We're not going to find out, and we shouldn't want to find out either. But it's not like today in the state of Israel, the most advanced country in the world, what goes on at Shaarei Tzedek and Machon Tua. I mean, it's beyond words, the miracles that are being done here for people that have trouble conceiving. No, Rav Shmaya Guraye was the only one of the six Rebbe's children to have a son. Barry Guraye, Shalom Dov Ber Guraye, Beryl, whatever name you know him by. My friends who are Lubavitchers and very close to the family know him as Barry. He's the only child, the only grandson. You have to remember, the Alter Rebbe had three daughters. One daughter perished in the Holocaust with her husband. That was the youngest. We spoke about it, the Horensteins. They were very close to the Rebbe, to the Rebbe in the Rebbetzin, to Chaim Mashka and Reb Menachem Mendel. I apologize. I know to a chassid, they don't like to use the Rebbe's first name. They say, but I'm not a chassid. I have to speak about him as a Torah Jew who's overwhelmed by his greatness, and as a historian, and we're all youngsters at one time. We, you know, the Rebbe, you hear his wife say, Beryl. I just saw a whole article written about kid who became Baal Tshuva, and he calls the Lichtensteins, he calls Toei, and he wants to talk with Abarin with questions about philosophy and literature. And he hears Toba say, Aaron, it's for you. So this kid later becomes my student, so I would like to ask him, what do you expect Tova to say to her husband? Harav Lichtenstein, it's for God have mercy if your wife calls, if I'm called the Rabbi Rakefet, I am in trouble, let me tell you that. I had one student, I was talking to her about her husband, I want to mention the name, and Adam Gadol, and I was proposing him for something very big, and she speaks about her husband, Harav, in third person. Oh my gosh, I thought, please. So the middle couple was the Rebbe and his wife. The eldest couple was Guraye. The Rebbe and his wife had no children. It's an amazing thing. And the only child was from the Guraye's. No, I want to ask you a question. Who should succeed? Who has the child? Who has the future? Okay, let me just say a few words about Barry. We'll come back to him later, but we'll come back to him already, unfortunately, in heavy, heavy machloket. Barry was born in 1923. He died in 2005. In his youth, overseas in Eastern Europe with his grandfather, he was a typical chassid. Worshipped the ground his grandfather walked in, dressed in a chassid, looked like a chassid, had all the attributes of a chassid, everything we spoke about yesterday in class. He married into one of the old-time Chabad families, famed and beloved. His father-in-law was Rabbi Baron Kasanovsky, if I'm pronouncing it right. There's a picture here of the Rebbe as a young man at one of the earliest Farbrengens, and here in the corner is Barry's father-in-law, from the elder of finest Hasidim you can imagine. Barry comes to America in 1941 with the Rebbe, with the family, saved from Hitler, goes to Torah Vadas, graduates Torah Vadas, Smicha, marries, fine shidduch. Then his uncle comes to America, and Barry shifts gears. His uncle, very fascinating what I'm about to say, life is stranger than fiction. His uncle becomes his role model. He broadens, goes to university, gets advanced degrees, becomes a scientist, did research as a physicist, Columbia U, John Hopkins, published research papers on physics. Many are available on the internet. You can check it out. Barry S. Gouraye, G-O-U-R-A-R-Y. Learned, accomplished. Moves into a much more, what we call in popular language today, a YU focus, modern orthodox, centrist. All these words that Rakefet objects to. I would rather call it a Torah Jew in Western context. Exactly like his uncle. It's fascinating. And his uncle, as the nephew, is moving into a different orbit, the uncle is shifting gears as well. Comes to America, minds his business, doesn't live with his father-in-law and mother-in-law, lives a few blocks away on President Avenue, works in the Brooklyn Navy Yard. I don't know if they have ever been able to really research exactly what the Rebbe did. They say it was a boat that was built there. He was the electrical engineer in charge of the electrical installations on the boat. It's all wartime secrets. Maybe records could be released today. Maybe there aren't detailed records. I always say where the Brooklyn Naval Yard was, they should put up a big plaque. Rebbe Menachem Mendel Schneerson, the seventh Lubavitcher Rebbe, worked here with the years. I believe it was like 42 to 45, if I'm not mistaken. But it's an unbelievable story. And while all this is happening, as we spoke about, the previous Rebbe is bringing the Rebbe, the seventh Rebbe, his son-in-law, more and more into work, into the orbit of Chabad. So, also fascinating, by the way, Barry and his wife had no children. They adopted, from what I understand. Again, I don't want to go any, be, I don't know, you know, what the world knows. I don't even want to mention names here. Adopted children and very well integrated into the greater YU world today. So that was Barry. Barry Gouraye, Shmaya Gouraye. And now we come to the $64 million question that every Litvak has asked and that yours truly discussed in great detail when I did the history of Torah in modern times before some of you were born. Tell me, what is this Hasidus all about? This is impossible. It's phony baloney. Open up a Tanakh, open up Nach. The greatest king, Tzaddikei Yesodei Olam, had sons who were Rishayim Gemurim. And kings who were Rishayim Gemurim had sons who were Tzaddikim Gemurim. Parentheses, I'll give you a reward for coming today. They once asked Rav Yosef Eliyahu Henkin, how could that be? Tzaddikim had Rishayim, Rishayim had Tzaddikim. He said, yeah, we know from Nach who the father was. We don't know who the mother was. Quote, end quote. Coming back here, how can you have Hasidus? What's going on here? We spoke yesterday about the Belzer Rebbe. just because this kid born in Tel Aviv in 1948, his father was Reb Mordechai de Bulgura Rav, who was the son of Reb Yisachar Dov, the Belzer Rebbe, and just because his uncle was Reb Ara Lerokach, that makes him a Rebbe, that makes him a Tzaddik, that makes him a Chosid, that makes him a London. What's going on here? Ribbono shel Olam. All right, we'll all agree the sixth Rebbe was special. So what? What does it have to do with sons-in-law? That's a very powerful question. And we know in the literature world where we got involved with family ownership of yeshivat, and you had to be a relative to be a Rosh Yeshiva, many of these yeshiva disappeared. Because when you bring in relatives whose yichus is, they're related to the previous Rosh Yeshiva, but they couldn't say a shir on a level to save themselves, the students don't come. We don't have to go any further than what happened in Cleveland with Tells. Go visit today, where Tells was once a kingdom. YU lives on. YU is a public trust. Rakefet has no yichus. At least we didn't know he had yichus, right? Or today, oh boy, do I have yichus. The best for YU goes without saying. Rabbi Revel, my cousin, you can't do better than that. Am I right or wrong? What do you say, Morty? Rabbi Revel, my cousin, Vic, can't do better than that? Absolutely. But when I was appointed to this faculty, I didn't know he was my cousin. They didn't know he was. If you open up the fourth edition now of Revel and read the introduction, you'll find out the secret. And now I found out. Okay, fine, good, wonderful. Why use a public trust? Torah Vedas is a public trust. Look what's going on in Panovich, because it's family. The grandson, the great. Look what went on in Bavav. Bavav 45, Bavav 48. They had a call. I'm an eyewitness. I'm in Borough Park Shabbos. The police totally surrounded Bavav. I said, what are you doing here? So they told me, don't you know they were throwing chairs at each other? This police lady, an Irish police lady, says to me, they were throwing chairs at each other last week. We're here. The minute the first chair will be thrown, we go in and separate. I couldn't believe my ears. Why you? Mechas Harav, public trust. Fabulous. Panovich family. Achlokin. Look at the Gush, look at Alon Shvut. You stand in awe. Rav Aharon and Rav Yehuda, both appointed successors in their lifetime. And what, Rabbi Gigi's related to anyone? Rabbi Madam is related to anyone? If you have the goods, we want you as Rosh Yeshiva. Rabbi Betnash is related to anyone? Our Rebbe here. All right, Rabbi Miller, you can say, fine, it's Rebbe. But he's here in his own right. I always would say about Rabbi Aharon, I always would get upset when people introduce Rabbi Aharon as Rabbi Soloveitchik's son was. Lift to say, I tell them, Rabbi Aharon would be Rabbi Aharon even if he wasn't Rabbi Soloveitchik's son. Understand it? What do you say? All right, as an afterthought, you can say. And the Rav was overjoyed to have Rabbi Aharon as his son-in-law. What I know in that area, no one else in the world knows, and I will not say it in public. Let it remain unsaid. I can tell you the Rav at Gechalish that Rabbi Aharon should become his son-in-law. And I know that as a fact because of something that happened right in front of my eyes. But Rabbi Aharon, it's Rabbi Aharon. All right, afterwards he fell in love with Tova. They had a fabulous marriage, raised unbelievable children. Give credit. So we're talking now Hasidus. The Hasidim sitting in front of me here. Come on. Don't fake me out with Narishkeit. Father's a tzaddik. I can be a Rasha. Kid is a Rasha. Son is a tzaddik. Come on. What's going on here? It's a good question. There's a very simple and powerful answer. My dear students, no one forces you to go to a Rebbe. Moshe, have you ever gone to a Rebbe for advice? Have you ever gone to... Yeah, who'd you get a bracha from?
It was the... Someone was sorry, I remember the Rebbe.
a Rebbe, we're not the Torah Masorah, doesn't have
Rebbe. Rebbe came to...
No, the Nova Minska. All right, you got a bracha from the Nova Minska. All right, the Yaakov Parallel, it's a good bracha. A friend of mine, I know him, beautiful. No, no one forced you to go. Your grandfather took you by the year, maybe you were forced at that age. But at your age, you decide you want a Rebbe. I was sitting Friday night at a table with very erudite, very accomplished, successful people this past Friday night. And there was a man there who studied in this very room. And he once came to me and said, Rebbe, he said to me, I need the Rebbe. I used to, the Lubavitcher was my Rebbe. He died. Can you suggest someone? So I suggested someone, the Biyana Rebbe, an American. I write about him in Washington. Know the family very well. Told his brother, his brother-in-law, his sister, etc. His father was my teacher. I heard Kiddush from his grandfather. So this person went to the Biyana. Whenever he meets me, he thanks me for sending him. You understand what I'm saying? And the Biyana thanks me for sending him as well. Beautiful shidduch. No one forced him. Free choice. You have to remember, no one forces a chassid to go to a Rebbe. If the Rebbe Tak is an oisvaf, a pushtak, a bum, whatever name you maledict him by, no, only a halfwit is going to go. Maybe you're in corruption with the Rebbe. You rob women of money when they come to ask for a bracha. Fine, so you share. But a normal Ben Torah, yeah, freedom of choice. When the Kutzke died, the Kutzke Hasidim split into three Kutz, some remain, Sachchav, Ger. Three different Hasidus. In the concentration camps, Jews saw the Kloisenberger Rebbe and the way he lived in the death camps. You know how many Jews became Kloisenberger Hasidim? Who never heard of Kloisenberg's sons before World War II? I know, I met Litvisha. Kloisenberger Hasidim, I couldn't believe it. They said to me, no, Mem Gizen in Laga, we saw him in the camps. And read what he did there, and the bodies, what he would always bury. I mean, it's unbelievable. Gentlemen, the greatest example I know of is what happened in the United States. The Lubavitcher Hasidim appointed the new Rebbe. They forced a young man named Reb Menachem Mendel Schneerson to give it all up. Give up his name, his privacy. Remember, we quoted Rabbi Steinsaltz last year. Very insightful. No one ever called him Mendeler again, outside of his wife. No one called him Mendy again. He lost his entire private personality. And he became the greatest Rebbe in the history of the Torah people, the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And it's an amazing thing, because at this very moment in time, today's date, September 7th, 2015, there are many Rebbeim alive. No one has more influence than the 7th Lubavitcher Rebbe. Just think for a minute. The Belza, the Gera, the Vishnitsa, the various Luzhina Luminehem. And I'm not putting anyone down. Chas v'chalila. Colin Stalin. No one has more influence than the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And the Hasidim forced his hand, forced history. It's a fabulous story. And I want to say something else to a mature audience. Natan, where were you raised? What community?
Queens.
Where in Queens? I know.
Jamaica
Estates, Hollisworth, Baruch Hashem. I had many, many students there. You know the Weingartens? All right. Alex, I write about him in Washington. How many students do you know that I write about? He's one of them. Natan. And this is sad. And it hurts. This is life. There's a pasuk in Kohelet God created man to be yasha, straight, decent. And yet we all go off the tracks, and there's endless machloket in life. And it's very sad. I can tell you a word I say all the time, and no one can argue with me. It's overwhelming. Did you ever wonder why Kibbutz Aviyim is a mitzvah? 10 commandments. 5th commandment. Kabeid et avicha v'yetimecha. What do you mean? What do you need a mitzvah for? Tana Rabbanan, the Gemara in Kedushin, first parak. Maze kibbut aviyim, machu kibbut aviyim, machnisu motziu, machilu mashkeu, machaseu v'chulu. What is kibbut aviyim? Parents grow older, you feed them, you give them to drink, you cover them, you wheel them in, you wheel them out. What's the big deal? That's what they did for you when you were a baby. I don't know, I've raised children, I've seen my grandchildren, I see my great-grandchildren today. My great-grandchildren, the younger ones, you got to wheel them in, wheel them out, dress them, change their diaper, feed them. No, if I borrow $100, a decent individual pays it back, right or wrong. If that's what your parents did for you, so you have to do that for them. This is part of life. It's not happy. With a child, you're very happy because a child is going to grow. An old person, a sick person, it's much sadder. I saw in America, all my friends come up, nobody is standing upright anymore. I feel, compared to them, I was so anxious to get back to the classroom and look at Natan and look at some youngsters and look at Moshe Hurt. When I look at Moshe Hurt, his name changed to Moshe Cure. Not Moshe Hurt. Got it? Hurt. You're hurting people. No, I look at you. You have cured me of my old age. With me, Moshe? Thank you. Charlie, what do you need a mitzvah? No, you studied Freud at university. I got a lot to talk about. Not for now. I heard the Rav discuss Freud. He's not entirely wrong. We all wind up, wow, my parents did this wrong, my parents did that wrong, I have this complaint, I have that complaint, my brother did wrong, my sister did wrong, this one hurt me, this one harmed me, this one that. And there isn't a family, lo aleinu, where you don't find ill feeling in the family. It's inevitable. Brother-in-law, the sister-in-law, Rabbi Parnas, I was very close, he should... I understand he needs refuah shleimah. He's not teaching this year. You should have her. He's a great individual. Taught at YU many years and then jumped ship to land the college with Rabbi. He's with your Rebbeim, right? Rabbi Braunschweiger, Rabbi Parnas. You know what I'm talking about. This is a Dor Chadash. They never heard of them already. So Teddy Parnas once said a vort that whenever Yontif comes, there's always more tension in the family than ever. Why? Because everyone gets together. Yontif, the brothers, the sisters, the nephews, the nieces, the cousins, the parents, the grandparents. And there's always machloket involved, always jealousy, always envy. And this is part of life, unfortunately. I wish it were not so. Those of you who know me, I'm a very poor example because I not only learned Musa, I tried to live Musa. I have fought with nobody since the wine incident back in 1961. I fought with nobody. Whenever I can, I'll compromise. If I can't compromise halachically, I'll explain. I can't compromise. It's a halachic principle, but I can't force you to do. Have that attitude towards my students. You know that I write about in Washington. I have students all the way through the Eidachar I did. All the way in Chovevei Torah, whatever they call it today, says Chovevei Torah, what's the YCT? YCT. Okay, YCT. All right. But how many individuals can live with some? Very few, very few. And I've seen families of Gedolei Yisrael, and I don't want to elaborate, in every last family of Gedolei Yisrael, that I knew intimately, and I knew many. Wow. You can do a novel. If I would write novels instead of writing the history of Torah, I would not be a poor man, and this kolel would be housed in luxury, not in the poverty of Gris, where students get no food and have to pay for electricity. It's a shame, an absolute shame. If Mr. Gris were alive, this would be a different ballpark. Take my word for it. But what can we do? He's gone, and yours truly has the privilege of perpetuating his name. Joe Gris, don't forget it. If this is the nature of the beast, then that's why you need a mitzvah. If there wouldn't be a mitzvah, 90% of the people would walk. And I know people who walked away, let their parents rot, let the city take over, it's not our concern, and they're busy with life, and who can look in on old people? And you know that senior citizens' homes, I don't want to go into more detail, there were tremendous scandals in the 70s because a certain Jew who I knew, and I knew the family, put bodies into frigidaires, kept them there, no one's visiting it every day anyway, and every day that he kept the body, he made money. Do you know how, Natan? The state gave him money through, you follow me, per diem. So instead of announcing the guy died January 22nd when he knew the family was coming to visit before Pesach, he announced in March that the person died. 32 days, 60 days, his only expense was the electricity of the morgue, okay? So we need a mitzvah. We're getting involved now in a tremendous machloket that left its scars on the inner Chabad families. Scars that remain until today. But I want to make it clear. It's not a negative comment on my part. It's only a realistic description of what happens in life. And with all the machloket, there are heroes that come out of it. Namely the Rebbetzin, and the Rebbe's brother-in-law, Reb Shmayahu Gerayeh. And let us begin. I won't finish today, and Dafka, very interestingly, this has been written up many, many different ways, but I'm Dafka quoting from a volume that's the least friendly to the Rebbe, the one that I referred to a minute ago. This is the Hebrew edition. This was the later edition, so I chose to work with the Hebrew edition because if it's later, it has more emendations and corrections. It's called HaRebbe Milubavitch, and this is by Menachem Friedman, and here Shmuel Samuel Heilman of the United States, professor of sociology in the New York area, becomes Shmuel Heilman. A very fascinating volume put out by Merkaz Zalman Shazar, and I'm quoting beginning on chapter 2, and beginning on page 50, he gives a detailed description of what happened when the Rebbe died. The sixth Rebbe died on Yud Shvat, 1950, 28th of January, 1950. The previous Rebbe, the sixth Rebbe, died on Shabbat. He was critically ill, and that Shabbat, he took a turn for the worst. The Rebbetzin came down, his wife, who was a public figure, came down to the Beis Medrash in 770, davened for the Rebbe, and that very morning the Rebbe died, news spread by word of mouth. Hundreds walked over to the 77 Shtibel to be with the Rebbe, to say Tehillim. Everyone was in a tremendous shock. The next day, the New York Times described a massive funeral. Eastern Parkway, three quarters of the lanes were blocked off so the cortege could proceed, the people could walk behind the cortege, and the sixth Rebbe was gone. It was almost taken as a given that Reb Shmayahu Gerayeh would succeed the Rebbe. He was the one, he was the son-in-law, he had lived with the Rebbe, his wife was the eldest daughter, I believe her name was Hannah, if I'm not mistaken, his mother-in-law Dina, am I correct, that was the name of the mother-in-law, Nechamadina, correct, I think, but I think she was called Dina. But Nechamadina, I yet knew people who knew her very well. She was very close to Rose Lieberman. And Nechamadina was a personality. She was a very strong personality. Some Hasidic Rebbeim have wives who stay in the background. Life forced her into the public eye because the sixth Rebbe had a stroke already in Europe. When he reached the United States, in a wheelchair. He couldn't speak. His language was not clear. She understood him. And whenever he held a public conference, he would speak and she would interpret his words into Yiddish that was audible. She was a real personality. When they were interviewed by the press, Rose Lieberman would sit next to the Rebbetzin Nechamadina and she would translate the Rebbetzin's Yiddish into English. So that this became a well-known family, and now the Rebbe is dead and they sit separate shivas. Now Chabad has an interesting custom, and I saw this with my own eyes when lo aleinu, what can I tell you, a human being sits shiva. We pray that children should sit shiva for parents and not vice versa, chas v'chalila. So I've, lo aleinu, had to sit shiva twice. Well, I sat shiva with my brother. Both times we're here. Our third brother didn't come. He sat where he sat. I'm trying to think, but I believe he already was in Las Vegas. He was in the Bronx when my father died. So he sat in the Bronx. Then my mother, he sat in Las Vegas. And my brother and I both sat here together. No, my brother and I are sitting together. We took turns davening. If my brother would daven mincha, I'd daven marav. If my brother would daven shachris, I would daven mincha. Or we would break off, you know, volatzion, ashrei, volatzion. We took turns. Have you seen a Chabad shiva? Each son makes a separate minyan and says the tefillah barabim and the kaddish. Separate minyanim. Both brothers-in-law sat shiva separately. Very fascinating. Chabad. Daven separately. Each one, while sitting shiva, had to answer questions, had to speak occasionally. And a lot of people felt the younger son-in-law is by far the greater genius of the two. His knowledge is indescribable. Kol HaTorah Kula Ba'al Peh. As the year developed, they both would speak in public. The younger brother-in-law, Rabbi Menachem Mendel, once a month, and everyone, or the overwhelming majority, flocked around him. This man is something special. Once in 1,000 years. How do you have people on his level? He was known as the Ramash, Rabbi Menachem Schneerson. The other brother-in-law was known as the Rashag, Rab Shmayahu Guraye. Many of the old-time Hasidim from Europe only knew the Rashag. And now, for the first time, they're getting to know the Ramash. And the Rebbetzin, the widow, has made it clear. She wants the Rashag to succeed her late husband. But time is ticking away. Hasidim are starting to form an opinion. And more Hasidim are reaching the conclusion, we want the Ramash. And tension is building up within the family. Hard to tell at exactly what moment Reb Menachem Mendel Schneerson realized he can't get away. He can't turn back the clock. Destiny is closing in upon him. Chassidim started coming to him for advice and giving him a pidyon nefesh. You all know when you go to a Rebbe, you leave a kvittel, and with the kvittel you leave a donation. Chabad at that moment was like other Chassidiyat. It doesn't exist today. Chabad is very, very different today. But at that moment, if you take a kvittel, you take a pidyon nefesh, it's a sign that you recognize that the Chassidim consider you a Rebbe. People started to come to him and ask for advice, ask for your chiddush, want to unburden themselves to him. And more are going to Reb Menachem Mendel. The Rebbetzin, the widow, is very upset. Petitions are coming in from Kfar Chabad in Israel, where you have a nucleus of Hasidim, some of them who know the seventh Rebbe personally, some of them who only hear of the seventh Rebbe, but hear over his Torah, his Gatlet, his knowledge, and they're petitioning. 770, make Reb Menachem Mendel the Rebbe. The pressure is building up. And finally, one full year, there is no official Rebbe. And on the yard site, Yud Shvat, rumors start to spread, there's going to be a Fabrengen. The yard site, what you call a Sudat Hilula among Hasidim, their concept of a yard site is very different than a Litvish concept. Michael Goldman. Michael, you ever see a Litvish yard site? You ever see the way the Rav held yard site for his mother, his father, his mother? He fasts all day. He davened shachris in the yeshiva. After that, he went into room 102, opened up a mishnayot, and for 4 hours taught mishnayot, and then they davened mincha in the room. It was unbelievable. The yard site was kulo Torah, kulo ruchniyot, kulo learning. Chassidim, yard site, big suda, l'chaim, say over Torah from the niftar, if it's a rebbe, all right. You know, I don't have to tell you, Michael, you would much rather prefer a golden Hasidic yahrzeit than a dusty misnatische yahrzeit. Absolutely. I understand it. Goldman, gold, Hasidic. You got it? Okay, Michael, good. So now Yud Shvat comes, and the rumor is starting to spread that Reb Menachem Mendel will accept the Rebbeship. And mind you, it is not coming from above. It is not coming from the Rebbetzin. It is coming from the masses. It is coming from the pressure. It is coming from the petitions that are coming in. And thousands are coming to 770 Yud Shvat. The whole Hasidus is just a few hundred families at that time. Hundreds and hundreds are coming. There's going to be this Hilula, this Fabrengen, And Reb Menachem Mendel walks in, and the Hasidim force him to sit up front. And he starts speaking. If you've seen a Fabregen, so what is a Fabregen? Sing a Nigen. They drink a L'chaim. The Rebbe speaks the Divrei Torah. They sing a Nigen. A L'chaim. And it goes on. And it's very different than Lubavitch. Because there's regular Divrei Torah. Divrei Torah that is nigla, that can be understood, that is tangible. And then there's what they call the Dvar Elokim Chaim, which is a Hasidic discourse based upon Kabbalah, based upon esoteric sources, to give the Dvar Elokim Chaim. Only the Rebbe can give it, not a Chassid. Chassid can speak the Divrei Torah, not the esoteric Kabbalistic Torah. And when the Rebbe gives it, they introduce it with a Nigen, and the Rebbe stands up, his eyes are closed, he holds a handkerchief in his hand. It is said the handkerchief is to keep him bonded to reality. He shouldn't float away into heaven, because when he's giving the Dvar Elokim Chaim, it's as if he's talking directly with and from the Ribbono Shel Olam, and everyone stands. That you have to see it to understand what I'm talking about today. You have videos of the Rebbe. I saw it in person, but that's only a Rebbe. That's the Dvar Elokim Chaim. And the Rebbe begins by giving Divrei Torah, and right in the middle, one of the elder Hasidim from England, Reb Avraham Sender Nimtzav was the name. If I'm not mistaken, he's the father-in-law of Dr. Nissen Mindel, who we spoke about last year. And he jumps up, and he says, Chassid in his late 80s, and he says to the Rebbe, who had just finished giving Divrei Torah and had just finished the Nigen and just finished the L'chaim, and he says to the Rebbe in front of anyone, V'nimtza chein v'seichel tov, he quotes the Pasuk, the Rebbe zelzogen Hasidish. We want the Rebbe to say a Maima Hasidish. And at that moment, Reb Menachem Mendel was silent. He was in deep thoughts, and suddenly he gave the word to sing the Nigen that would introduce the Dvar Elokim. Stood up, closed his eyes, and said, not Divrei Torah, but Hasidus, Kabbalah. I'll tell you in a second what he spoke about. And at that moment he became Rebbe. The very person who had asked him to give the Hasidus, made a Shechiyanu b'shem v'malchut, that Chabad had a seventh Rebbe. I don't think he understood the full impact of what this man would accomplish. It shouldn't have been a Shechiyanu, it should have been a Tov HaMeitiv. Because we had a seventh Rebbe, there are hundreds of thousands of Jews in the world today who are Shomer Mitzvot and have a connection with Yiddishkeit. It's beyond comprehension. One man, one little man. Excuse me?
Who was it that was Mubarak?
The one who told him, the elder Chassid, who told him to say Hasidus. He said, the Rebbe Zolzagin Hasidus. And what he spoke about, what the Rebbe spoke about, see, the sixth Rebbe gave a famous maimah Basi Lagani. And I'll just say it very briefly, and I actually want to show you sources, because I deal with it in a similar fashion in the Rav. Bati Lagani, but Chredvi Achasid, Basi Lagani. You're talking in Shia Shirim. The Ribbono Shel Olam says, I've come to my God, and he's come to the earth. And of course, there's a tremendous philosophic question here. Why does God have to come down to a garden? What does he need earth? The Rav spoke about this many times. What does the Ribbono Shel Olam need us for? Here, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, we speak about we're going to create a Ketam Malchut for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We're going to make God king. What does he need us? We're making God king. Who are we? What are we? Here today, gone tomorrow, mortals, sinners. I don't have to tell you, human beings, what we're capable of doing. But you see, God needs the world. Without us, he would not be the Ribbono Shel Olam. We need him, and he needs us. It's like a Rebbe and Talmidim. It's why we can't give credit to students who are going to listen, virtual students, they want credit. It's a relationship. It's a Talmud Rebbe, it's Mesorah, it's the passing on of the Torah, Dor L'Dor Yishabach Ma'asecha. We need each other. The Havdil, the Ribbono Shel Olam, without the human being crowning him king, he's not king, he's in heaven. Plays no role. Without the human being living his Torah, he plays no role. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe continued on this theme that the sixth Rebbe spoke about, Basi Lagani. And the words he said, the encouragement, the acknowledgement. Why did my father-in-law come here? And he quotes the Rebbe on that very famous first night in America, which I've spoken about so many times, where they took the Rebbe. I was the Greystone Hotel, I believe, on the west side. And the elder Chassidim came into the Rebbe. And they told the Rebbe, the sixth Rebbe, Rebbe, you've suffered enough, you're paralyzed, you've suffered under the communists, under the Nazis. We're happy to tell the Rebbe we are retiring him, we're going to support the Rebbe. And they even arranged in Lakewood, there was some Chabadnik there, had grown up in Chabad, American, had a hotel, had money. They arranged, Rebbe, you're going to have a beautiful apartment there, and once a month we're going to come out, Shabbos Mevarchim, before, after, whatever, we'll set it up, we'll fabrein with the Rebbe can enjoy his final years in comfort. And the Rebbe told the seventh Rebbe, you can verstehen, was war Kriyat Shema, gesagt der Nacht, you can understand what type of Kriyat Shema I said that night, that the Chassidim are telling me, I'm finished. And the next morning he called them in, and he said, where I come from, a Rebbe tells Chassidim what to do, not the opposite. Ich werde abruhen, ein paar Wochen, I'll rest up a few weeks, and then I will start out again to show that America is no different than the Alter Heim. And this is exactly Chabad. Basi Lagani. I have to come into the garden of human endeavor and sanctify it with the Word of God. And I'll end off with a little story. See, I'm not a chassid, but I understand Chabad. It's unbelievable what one man accomplished. It's unbelievable. Unbelievable. And I just saw it the other day. My wife and I were in the center of town in Talpiyot. So we put the chopping to this. We went upstairs. There's a restaurant. We figured we'll have lunch there. Fine. In Hadar, Kanyon Hadar. And, typical place. Waiters. One with a kippah, one without a kippah. Nice people you see, good, wonderful. Order, food, not bad, fine. And then I see a Chabadnik walking. And he calls over the waiters, the one with the kippah, the one without a kippah, soon puts on a kippah. And it's about 11:45, and they're putting on tefillin saying Shema and Shema Meshre. And this Chabadnik, you can tell a Chabadnik right away. And he sees I'm looking with joy. Guess he saw the kippah. He understood that he doesn't have to ask me to put on tefillin. And he went like this to me twice. And I went back. And with that siman, with that movement, it was an entire conversation. We didn't have to say words. You understand what was happening. If you look at the Rebbe and the videos, the Rebbe, when the singing, when Chabad, thousands of eyes are upon him, like this. It was unbelievable, the turmoil that would rise, the sinking. It was one hand, understand? It's like one to baseball language, a grand slam homer at the bottom of the ninth to win the game. The crowd goes crazy. I described it in Washington, that in Rav Heschel Schechter's father's shul, it was three blocks from Yankee Stadium. When the Magic hit a home run, the shul was shaking. Mamish, Ani Lam, Rabbi Lam taught there. He's here now. I ought to bring him to say, Eidut Nemanah, that Rakefet doesn't lie. He said when there was a home run, he couldn't go on teaching. He had to stop for 2 minutes until they got... So the Rebbe, Lahavdil. So you see, that chassid looked at me and he said, I understand just what you're saying, but only Lubavitch. And this guy with the kippah, what, he didn't put on tefillin in the morning? Evidently not. And he comes there, he says he comes there every day to put tefillin on. This is Chabad. This is the Rebbe. This is Basri Lekani. To summarize, we're just touching the surface. To summarize, what did we do today? Well, the Rebbe in Berlin, I think we gave an honest description. France, we spoke about before, but we put it into context. And he and the Rebbetzin were very happy there. They applied for French citizenship. Deutsch actually found the application where they applied for French citizenship. This is the late 30s already. Who could ever dream what was going to happen? America, he wanted to get lost. Rav Shmaya Gariah, the Rashag. But the Ribbono Shel Olam willed otherwise. And the pressure of the Hasidim, and see, that's the ultimate answer. Yes, a Litvak is right. If a Gaon and a Chassid, you can have a kid in Eisvach just because his father, every kid, the Freud, the hatred, my father, this, he forced me, he didn't understand me, he didn't show me love, he didn't get, I've heard complaints about parents. Well, no, it's unbelievable what children can come. I gave lectures on Hibur Aviyim, hear it on the internet. What can I tell you? Nathan, you want to know something in life? Take off 49 years now and listen to the YUTorah.org, okay? And they're shurim there 49 years, and the emotional will not count the years. It's Yosef HaTzadik. When Yosef HaTzadik got out, Mendelovich, I spoke in public the first time he got out, and I just got back from Russia. And I spoke about the years he sat in prison, God will not count in his chronological age, understand? And I just told them that yesterday, okay? I said it in 1981, and I just said it again yesterday in 2015. So take 49 years and hear something and learn something, please, accomplish. Basi Lekani. Okay, Bezrat Hashem, we will pick up where we left off. As I said, the Sunday, next time we meet, first of all, Lativa Vachatoin Datoma, Lekulchem, Lishnat Chaim, Shalom, Osha, Va'osha, Besorah Tova, Tvakol, Tuv, Salar, Alengu, Val, Kol, Yisrael. Next week, there are no classes. Sunday is Erev Rosh Hashanah. The week afterwards, there are two classes. I'm certainly, that Sunday, I'm not teaching. It's a press conference. I wanted to give a press conference, Hanukkah time. I wanted to teach now. I came back to teach. I'm sick and tired of answering foolish questions about foolish things going on. But we don't have a choice. I'm being pressured from America, too. I got so many calls already, and I never saw so much going on at once. It's unbelievable. You don't have a minute to catch your breath. So I'm giving a press conference. I hope that Monday I can teach and that the press conference doesn't carry over.
Where's the press conference?
Right in this room at 5:15.
We can come?
Who am I giving it for? You don't know what the word press conference means? Rabbi Lichtenstein's word, it means I'm answering questions my students have asked me. And while I believe I know all your questions, you're free to put into my box in Sherry's office. It says Rakefet. Put in your question. And this week I'm preparing all the topics I'm talking on. I have it already. It's a big box in my office of material. This won't help. A very interesting thing, very sad. Chabad has a minhag they give out. When you get married, they give out a gift. But a gift, they give out a kuntres of the Torah, interesting things. So Rabbi Krinsky, the famous Rabbi Krinsky, one of the Rebbe's main gabayim, gave out, page 11, gave out a kuntres when he was the Rebbe's right-hand man on some of the things that happened. So there, he has here, on page 11, in 1987, that they were doing something in Boston and they had to do something, prepare a campaign for Chabad, and he was talking with the Rebbe about Boston, and when he mentioned Boston, the Rebbe asked him, how does Rav Soloveitchik feel? And I answered the Rebbe that this week I met his Talmud, Julie Berman, at a wedding, at the Jacobson wedding, and I asked him, how is the Rebbe? How is your Rebbe? And Julie Berman began to cry because of the detriment in the matzav briyuto shel harav lesefto. So it's very, very interesting here. You're a Chabadnik, you'll appreciate that. Very good material. If anyone's interested, my Talmud Shmuley Winiaz did a very nice piece on the legacy of Rav Meir Kahana. It reflects my own thinking. You're welcome to it. Mizrahi is celebrating 100 years since the yahrzeit of Rav Reines, the founder of Mizrahi. I yet knew Rabbi Reines's son. I have two copies of this, also very, very interesting. You've all heard of Rabbi Yecheskel Abramsky, the great Parshan on the Tosefta. He lived a few blocks from here, one of the original people who lived in Bayit Vagan. He was Av Beit Din in London, saved from the communists, story upon story. I yet knew one son of his. He had another son who I didn't know, lived in London, became a and Apikoros Lo Aleinu, gave it all up, as we spoke about before, Tzaddikim, his sons. He had one of the greatest libraries of socialist literature. And here it's both the same articles, how the atheist son of a Jewish rabbi created one of the greatest libraries of socialist literature. New York Times article, very fascinating, about a young lady named Esti Ackerman, no relationship to me, although my children are Ackerman, my eldest family is Ackerman, and she is the outstanding champion in the United States, if I'm correct, in table tennis. As a matter of fact, where she lives in West Hempstead, okay? And the article, and now who she defeated, who she won. And now the National Tabus Tennis Championships in Las Vegas, and it's scheduled for Shabbos Friday night. And her parents say, you make the decision, and she decides not to play. My wife's comment is, why did her parents let her make the decision? Doesn't a young lady need parental guidance? You can throw it out. Here's an article by Mark Shapiro, the indefatigable rabbi, doctor, professor, Talmud of Aaron Rakefet, Mark Shapiro, on Reb Chaim Dovber Gulevsky. Very interesting article. Not I know Gulevsky. I would write it a little differently, but it's interesting. Rabbi Gulevsky is a grandson of Reb Simcha Zelig Riga, the Dayan of Brisk, who was Reb Chaim Brisk's right hand. That is Gulevsky, and two articles from Chabad interviews, and this is for a chassid, unbelievable, Dr. Les Rosenthal, Mrs. Rose Shraga, and the Rebbe, his ability, with thousands upon thousands of people bothering him, how he could relate to each individual, and how he could say, when all the doctors claim this guy is about to die, Dr. Les Rosenthal, and the Rebbe says is garnished, and he comes back after all the new tests, and the doctors look at him, we don't know what to tell you. Everything showed before you're going to die, and these tests come back, and Staka garnished, and he's alive and kicking today. Anyone interested, put out by my Talmud from this very kolon, Rabbi Dr. Seth Farber, a series of books. This is the one on marriage in Israel, explaining to someone who doesn't know what marriage is about, giving him a little bit of insight. And finally, last but not least, in B'Sheva, which is one of the freebies that is terrific in Israel. I get a free paper every day, Yisrael Hayom, and Friday I get HaShavua B'Sheva. There's an interview here with a student of mine from many years ago, Yaffa Lisa Schmidman. It's Rabbi Schmidman's daughter-in-law. You know Rabbi Schmidman. And this lady came in Aliyah many years ago, raised her family here at the fair. I've never seen such love and understanding of Israel. And I'm very proud of this young lady. I knew her parents, Rabbi, very well, Rabbi and Libby and Rabbi Abe Chill of Rhode Island, if that means anything to you. So until we meet again in health and happiness, it should be a great Rosh Hashanah, and Besor HaTovot Aleinu V'al Kol Yisrael, and let us forget those magic words, Das V'danya.
Here's the for calling on me during class. That's the coffee during the class. That was good.
That's to wake you up, and also I should learn your name.
Yeah.
Hurt.
Yeah,
how do you know? Right. She's adopted. That's a sad chapter. That's a very sad chapter. But we'll deal with it. You know, we're just
special service.
So we have to look.
We're warming up, as the Rebbe used to say.
The
daughter, Glenn Ackerman.
That's
from the east side.
Yeah.
Good.
Schwimmens are my parents' best friends.
Who are your parents' best friends?
Schwimmens.
One second. So your parents are here in Aliyah?
No, not yet.
So one second, how did they know them?
They did Jamaica States for a while. Before they came in Aliyah, they did Jamaica States.
I see.
You know Mirza from Jamaica States? Newman? My cousin.
Yeah. And one second, where do you live?
Now, Lower East Side.
Yeah, Rebbe, this is Saul.
So you know Baruch Simon? Rabbi Baruch Simon. I say Rabbi, except he's our nephew.
He's our nephew.
So he's married to my husband's niece.
Rabbi Baruch Simon.
But he's my nephew, so I can call him Baruch. But in third person, we say Rabbi Baruch Simon.
He owes his life to Herbie Willig. To right or wrong. Know what I'm saying?
I don't know. I'm not sure I follow, but...
And I know Alex Weingarten, too. He's my mother's doctor and my friend from Queens College.
Herbie Willig worked with his father.
I know a lot.
His father. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Baruch Simon.
That's my brother's brother.
Yeah.
Sure.
Baruch's father was not that religious.
Baruch's is an accountant.
Correct.
Baruch Simon.
And Herbie convinced them to send them to Flatbush.
Oh, please, that Janet.
Herbie Willits, the Thunder of Rockways, Morty Willits Uncle.
Yes. They're great. The Simons are great. Jack and Shirley. They're
Baruch
Hashem. Baruch Hashem.
Well, your father's name again? Yeah, Joel Cohen, the doctor, and Pearl, she's the redhead. This is their son.
I probably know by sight.
Please give my best to them, okay? Janet Rizal, you want me to write it down? Have a pen? I'll write that for you. Because if you want my husband, you're going to forget. Should I write down a paper for you? Please give my best. Are you here, Great Aliyah?
I'm here in the Colo.
You're in the Colo, very nice. If I knew you, you probably were 2 years old. I'm only 32 because I stopped, but...
A quick question.
She knows me very well.
I know you talk about the mother-in-law that was in favor of the older child first.
Lisa,
how is the feelings
cousin,
of the Rebbe in terms of dealing with his mother-in-law's feelings in terms of
the fact that
he went over his mother-in-law's head, so to speak, in terms of doing that? It's question number one.
We're going to talk about that.
And question number two is that how is... This, in particular, you mentioned one of the Hasidim got up and said, what happens if what if the other side would have said,
it's good to get a few words.
There would have been a conflict right then and there on the stage. You know what I mean?
But the Elder Chassid, by then it was 99%.
Now you see a resemblance.
So it became
a landslide.
It became a vote, so to speak. So why don't they vote
very fast
and have the same thing? In other words, why are they into this? I don't want to say mishigas in terms of whatever it is.
Because
he proclaimed that
he forced himself into
court, locked himself into something.
Even though we're coming home, Mamish, I'm going to Gateway.
Yep.
What I saw in the
show. Okay, make sure you give your parents my regards, okay? That's so nice. You know our mother, redhead, we've seen them a lot. From Jamaica State, Pearl and Joel Cone. Yeah, they dive in within the barcode.
But okay, it keeps you comfortable.
Rabbi Rakefet, did you used to teach in TI maybe?
No.
No? So then I don't know.
I taught in what today's called TA. I was a Rebbe.
Okay.
And there I went in Aliyah.
Yes.
Then I taught the BMT, Gold,
Okay.
But the one lasting place was here.
So you probably had my nieces, not me. Okay.
15 years ago, I stopped all the college teaching, just the COVID.
Yeah, very
for
nice.
For many reasons.
Very nice.
I can give all three of you a
Good. All right. So come get a lift.
Oh, good. Save a lot of time.